When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There is a very dangerous and very effective destabilization campaign underway against this president, his administration, and his agenda. And what I hope that the president and his senior aides understand is that these forces are not just looking to delegitimize him. We often talk about that. Sure, they want to do that. They want to personally destroy him, destroy his presidency, and they would like to see the man in prison. I hope that the president understands I am not overstating this, having been a victim of this myself. They are out for blood. And the reason they have to destroy him is that Donald Trump is an alien organism that has been injected into the body politic by the American people to reform it. He must not be allowed to succeed. They have swarmed him. They have swarmed everybody around him in order to reject him out of the system, just like any alien organism. He must not be allowed to succeed. And I hope that everybody around him now understands that this is a war and that they started a long time ago. But they will not end until they get the President of the United States.
Hey guys, I'm Monica Crowley, and this is the Monica Crowley Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me here as we kick off yet another week of chaos in Biden's America. This is your go-to for hot liberty, a safe space for all of us thought criminals, independent thinkers, and yes, amidst it all, happy warriors. Check me out on social media. On Instagram, I am at Monica Crowley _. And on Twitter and True Social, I am at Monica Crowley. Also by email, I can be reached at MonicaCrowleyPodcast@gmail.com. Later today, we're going to speak with Amber Smith, who was a combat helicopter pilot in the 101st Airborne Division, which is the legendary 101st. She flew combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. She's got a new book out exposing how dangerous the new woke military is. Guys, we are in an existential moment for this country, and if we do not have a military full of lethal professionals who can fight and kill the enemy if necessary, and instead we've got a bunch of woke clowns running the operation out of the Pentagon, which we do, we are in a very, very dark moment here, very dangerous for all of us. We are going to have that conversation with Amber Smith here moments away. It is something you must here. Remember when the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, who as we now know was totally political and plotting against Donald Trump from the Pentagon, completely illegal. This is the stuff of dictatorships. And we're going to get into this today. I've got a whole monologue on other stuff of the state of the race and the latest polls. I'm throwing it all out because we need to have a much bigger conversation right now. Mark Milley was part of it. This is all a rolling overthrow of the American government. And General Milley, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was part of this whole overthrowing of the Constitution, the rule of law, the separation of civilian control of the military with the command and control at the Pentagon. We put control over the military in the hands of civilians, a civilian commander-in-chief, for a reason. So you do not have military coups. And yet Mark Milley, Mr. I want to understand white rage, he was leading the military for a long time. It's not just him. It goes all the way through. This communist revolution that we are living through right now, and again, we're going to deal with this today, is shot through in the military. It's not like you can rely on the military to be a bulwark against all of these raging Marxists seeking now to finally overthrow the country. You can't rely on the military for that. The military is part of it now. We are going to have this conversation with Amber Smith later today. Later in the week, we're going to be joined by Senator Tommy Tuberville, who has been all over the Title IX stuff, trying to protect women and girls in sports, but also in their safe spaces, like locker rooms, like bathrooms. And we have talked to him about this before. He has been one of the very few voices trying to fight back against all of this stuff. The Biden administration just reversed Title IX, which Richard Nixon signed into law. Senator Tuberville is going to be here to tell us how he is trying to fight back against this other element of this Marxist revolution. Okay, and it's all of a piece. Again, we're going to deal with this today, but Senator Tuberville is going to join us later in the week with this piece of this, the gender agenda, which again is part of the bigger picture. Next week, we're going to be joined by the spectacular Tulsi Gabbard. She is going to be here. She's got a new book out talking about how she left the Democrat Party, how the party really left her. And now she is a registered independent. She's absolutely in the running to be vice president with Donald Trump. Again, I don't know how far up she is in that ladder. I think the rankings change day to day based on what President Trump is thinking, but she is absolutely in the running, and I really like her personally. So she's going to join us here next week. Be ready for that. And we've got a number of other big things planned on this show, so stay tuned and tell everybody you know. First up today, the Monica Memo. Again, as I mentioned, I had a whole monologue about the state of the race, breaking down some of these new polls, swing state polls, national polls, all very bad news for Joe Biden, which is why you're seeing what you are seeing unfold in the country today. So I want the Monica Memo today to focus on the nature of the mob and the nature of the revolution. I cannot think, except maybe the American Revolution, I cannot think of another revolution that did not operate on the basis of a mob and mob mentality. So you go back to the ancient Greeks, the fall of the Roman Republic, and then the fall of the Roman Empire. You had mobs descending on them, uprooting the entire system of government, in some cases for a good reason. Okay, because they're being oppressed, etc. But you don't get this kind of radical change unless you have a mob that is activated. Sometimes the mobs are organic. Sometimes they are professionally agitated to be sent into the streets. And certainly that's the lesson of the 20th century. But you go back in history, the fall of the Roman Empire, mobs. The crucifixion of Jesus Christ, a mob, crucify him. So they unleashed the criminal, the murderer, the known murderer, and crucified Jesus at the behest of the mob. Fast forward, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the communist revolutions of the 20th century, all the way through, it is the mob. People generally want to belong to a bigger cause. They want to have a bigger meaning to their life. And especially if they don't have faith in God or any kind of spiritual backing, there's nothing to fill that void. If you're a believer in God, that fills the void. But if you are not, you are very easily manipulated. What's that old saying? If you believe in nothing, you'll fall for anything. Well, that's exactly right. And people who orchestrate these kinds of dangerous revolutions know that, and they know how to target the majority of people who may not have a core spiritual set of values and faith that fills that void. So they're always looking for something else to fill it. And they're looking for a higher cause. They're looking for something bigger than themselves to be involved in. And so dark revolutionaries, people who seek to manipulate people in service of an ideological agenda or in service of the big search for power and control over other people, they know this and they manipulate it very, very well. Mob violence always ends badly. And again, all of those episodes throughout history that I just laid out end very badly. It's an implosion of the society, and it almost always ends in extreme violence. Extreme violence. You think about the French Revolution, which started with a noble cause. It was coming out of the American Revolution for freedom and equality. And that was all, that was the French Revolution slogan, freedom, equality, fraternity. And it devolved, it collapsed on itself, and it devolved into the Reign of Terror and the guillotine. So you had thousands and thousands of people die at the end throughout the French Revolution, but because the mob then took over and it became totally radicalized, you had the guillotine, people losing their heads. French Revolution. Okay, then you, the Russian Revolution, that was communist revolution, that's a different motivator, collapsed into real violence. The red communists versus the white communists, the whole thing implodes. And then communist revolutions throughout the 20th century. Anytime you get a revolution, especially one driven by a negative force, you are going to have extreme violence. The Maoist revolution in China, so we dealt with the Russian Revolution. The Maoist revolution in China, take a step back here, guys, because I'm telling you all of this to frame what is actually happening now in the United States and, frankly, across the West. This is not just limited to us. Mao alights on the scene. You have the Communist Revolution in China in 1949. Mao himself was trying to lead the revolution in a certain direction, but the Communist Party in China, that he, of course he was sitting atop of, did not want to do what he wanted to do, did not want to go quite as crazy as Mao wanted to go. So what did he do? Mao went around the party, and he said, all right, fine, we're going to do our own cultural revolution, and I'm going to lead it, and I'm going to go around the party by going directly to the most useful idiots of them all, college kids. And so Mao took his revolution, took his idea of a cultural revolution directly to campuses, universities, kids who were already being indoctrinated into the Communist Revolution, so that they had already, their minds had already been shaped in that direction, and they were good little communists. But Mao wanted to ratchet it up. And so he went to the college campuses and got these kids going. And they began to do what every totalitarian does. And look, it's not just communist revolutions. The Nazi revolution, same thing, where they went in on university campuses, radicalized those kids. Then they ratcheted down the age. So you had Hitler Youth, these kids being radicalized from the time they come out of the womb. They are radicalized as good little Nazis or good little communists. And then the totalitarian playbook is to weaponize the children against their parents, weaponize the children against their families, weaponize the children against traditional society, and get them snitching on each other. So they start snitching on their parents. All you have to do is go back and read Animal Farm and 1984. Orwell lays it all out, because those two volumes were based on the totalitarian dictatorships of Nazi Germany and Stalinist Soviet Union. And how these things are weaponized. They go after the colleges first. They weaponize and radicalize those kids. They get them acting out violently, first peacefully and then violently. And then the revolution spreads. It spreads out of the college campuses into the city streets. Then it spreads into the countryside. Then it spreads across the broader country. This is the standard revolutionary playbook. Dividing up the nuclear family. Guys, what do you think this whole gender agenda is about? It's not about protecting a 65-year-old Caitlyn Jenner, who made an informed decision as a grown adult to make this transition. The fact that they are going after now babies, literal babies, that if you want to get your baby on a track to a different gender, you're going to be able to do that. And in fact, parts of Europe now are going down that track. In the UK, they're pushing back, but the rest of Europe, forget about it, right? So again, this is all part of the revolutionary scheme that is tried and true over the last, certainly century. And now that, since they've been at this for so long, we're at this tipping point now, and that's why they're pushing forward in this kind of super brazen way. Okay? So when you understand what the playbook is, Mao, what you're living through now is a Maoist cultural revolution, more so than, say, a Vladimir Lenin kind of standard, getting off the train at Finland Station with a gun kind of thing. This is more of a Maoist cultural revolution. And so Mao went into the colleges, then radicalized the kids all the way down. Nazis did the same thing. And then they start, like, with the sit-ins and the protests, and then it escalates to violence, and then it escalates beyond that to a wholesale destabilization of the society. That's what we are living through right now in America. Now, keep in mind that once these forces are unleashed, and I've got a great piece in today's Human Events, humanevents.com. I'm going to post it all over my social media as well, about sort of how these revolutions, once the forces are unleashed by the leaders, they do take on a life of their own. And they start to get more and more violent, more and more radical, more and more extreme. And it did happen to Mao. In fact, it got so crazy in the Cultural Revolution, where these kids were absolutely bloodthirsty, and so many others were so bloodthirsty, the streets were literally running with blood in Peking and Shanghai and elsewhere. Blood just flowing like crazy in the streets. People became like rabid dogs, which is what the mob does. The mob, when you're in a mob mentality, and so many psychologists and others have written volumes on this, I'm not an expert, but what I do know is that the mob mentality, once it takes over, you are operating as a collective, communism, you are operating as a collective, you are not operating as an individual. They strip the individuality and the critical thinking out of your brain, so you are going down the road of collective thinking and collective action. This is the history of every totalitarian dictatorship. You see the videos of regular Germans by the millions in the streets at Nuremberg or whatever, and Hitler is coming by in the car, and he puts his arm up in the Nazi salute, and millions of arms go up all at the same time. First of all, they did it because they were terrified that if they didn't, they'd be shot in the streets, because the Nazis, of course, had total control. But they also did it because they were being swept along the river by the rapids of revolution, by the rapids of the mob mentality. Mob mentality makes people act and do things that they would never do if they had their heads about them and if they were acting as individuals. Revolutionaries know this, so they stoke the mob. In Mao's case, as I started to say, the mob got so extreme and bloodthirsty, just like the Reign of Terror in France after the French Revolution. It got so crazy that even Mao had to pull it back at one point. So once these forces are unleashed, they do take on a life of their own, and they get completely out of control, even out of control of the people who unleash the forces and try to rein it in. So you're talking about very, very dangerous situations here. And as we talk about on this show, it is demonic. Okay, all of this is a spiritual war. This is God versus the enemy, good versus evil, however you want to couch it. But that is what is going on here. These forces that have been unleashed are demonic, dark, very dangerous. Spiritual battle, okay? So I say all of this, number one, because I've been talking about this for years. And it, now more and more people are talking about it, and it's more out there. But I remember being on Fox News, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, and raising this and having people I respect and admire very much, like Bill O'Reilly and Don Imus, and I was on their show all the time. And I used to talk about it. You know, I thought it might sound a little crazy if I talked about communism, so I would soften my language and talk about how this was a socialist revolution. I use the S word instead of the C word, just to try to draw people in and get them to listen. And everybody was like laughing at me at the time. Ah, communism, Crowley, you're crazy. Not here. Communism died at the end of the Cold War. Nonsense. Nonsense. No, it just takes on a different life. And a different life form, which is what you are now seeing all across our country. Guys, I have spent my entire career studying communism, studying these kinds of revolutions. I wrote my PhD dissertation about China and U.S. relations with China in both the 1940s and 50s, going up to Richard Nixon and the opening to China. I've studied this a long time. I talked to President Nixon about communism because he built his entire career on anti-communism. I spent hours and hours talking to him about it. I've studied this for a very long time, and I've been talking about it for a long time. So while it's great to see everybody else bringing up the rear here and talking about this, I've been doing this a long time, and I know this is why you come to this show, because you get it before you get it elsewhere. I am all for as many voices revealing the truth as possible, but I've been banging this drum for a very long time, okay? So now to see it culminating in this tipping point moment terrifies me. You know, I've been talking about it, but we on our side have been ignoring it for decades, as we've been doing other things, focused on other issues, raising our families, building small businesses, building our careers, taking care of our communities. We've been doing all that stuff. Meanwhile, the left, the communists, have had their eyes on the prize, which is destroy the United States of America and the broader West. And they've been doing it through infiltration. They've been doing it by taking over all of our institutions, academia, the news media, the culture, movies, television, music, the government. Senator McCarthy was right. He was right in the 1950s when he was trying desperately to expose communist infiltration in our government. They marginalized him, smeared him, attacked him, and destroyed him. In retrospect, you know he was right, right? The communists infiltrated our entire government to now the point all these decades later they control it. They control, and they control the agencies that have the weapons, meaning the military. We're going to talk to Amber Smith about that in a minute, but the security state, the intelligence services, law enforcement, they control it all now because they've been doing it for a long time. Eyes on the prize, long-term project. And now we are at the, I think, really the culmination of this. I mean, this is going to go one way or the other, and we don't have much time. What you are now seeing on college campuses, the pro-Hamas terrorist sympathizers destroying universities, camping out, chanting Intifada is the revolution and all of that. Understand, this is all the same revolution. As the saying goes, the issue is not the issue. The issue is always the revolution. So you go back to the Vietnam War and the sit-ins, including at my alma mater, Columbia University. During the Vietnam War, they took over the president's office, and they were mostly, at the time, peaceful. They took over the president's office at the time, doing mass sit-ins. You had sit-ins across all universities. Sometimes it would tip over into violence, like at Kent State, which I believe was 1970. But what we now know is that those those college kids who were protesting the Vietnam War weren't peaceful, that they were provoking the National Guard and provoking the police and just provoking and engaging in violence and throwing bottles and stuff. And so the National Guard struck back. Again, it's complicated, but you have to understand it's all the same revolution. Those kids mostly were protesting the draft. Okay? But the Soviet Union at the time saw a real opportunity here and came in, and they were stoking the countercultural revolution. And they had millions of useful idiots in these college kids that were like, oh, anti-war. Most of them did not want to be drafted and go to Vietnam and get their butts shot off. That I get. But you had America's enemies going in and stoking these anti-war protests, playing on those fears, playing on the idealistic sentiment of these kids, stoking these things, getting them going, pushing it into violence. America's enemies, of course, of course. And so that's why you had these protests take on a life of their own in the late 60s and early 70s, all branded as the Summer of Love and everything else. Nonsense. All geared toward destabilizing American society, chipping away at our institutions. And then, of course, you fast forward to the 80s and you had the Reagan no nukes. Big, people forget all of this, but Reagan wanted to modernize the American nuclear arsenal, bring it up to par. The Soviets at the time when Reagan came in had a nuclear advantage over us. So Reagan was all about rebuilding and modernizing the military, including our nuclear arsenal. And the left got in there, along with the Soviet Union and other adversaries, got in there and stoked these massive nationwide protests, which people forget about now. But you had millions of people in the streets. No nukes. No nukes. Destabilize American society, right? And then fast forward to the Iraq War. Millions of people back in the streets screaming about George W. Bush being a war criminal. Destabilize American society. And then, of course, in 2020, you had Antifa and Black Lives Matter burning down the country over a lie. George Floyd did not die by cop. He died of a fentanyl overdose. And what we now know is the left got in there. They manipulated the autopsy results and report. It buried everything, created the lie that it was police brutality, and burned down the country. Destabilized society. Fast forward now to these pro-Hamas terrorist sympathizers destroying these universities. It's now spilling over, as revolutions do. Again, it is all the same revolution. All the same revolution. The issue is not George Floyd or Israel versus Hamas. The issue is always the revolution. Keep that in mind as you watch all of this. My alma mater is being absolutely attacked, and it's poor leadership at the top. Columbia University president, a woman named Shafiq. I'll leave that there. She was the former head of the London School of Economics. She's a radical as well. So, you know, these university presidents are torn between having to ensure the safety of all of their students and some orderly structure to the university so kids can actually learn. I mean, they're learning leftism and revolution, but they still have a responsibility to ensure that, versus their own communist impulse to revolution. They're torn between the two strains, right? And so, they let these protests go, First Amendment and all of that. Well, at Columbia overnight, it spilled over into actual violence. They took over an iconic hall, and I know it well. It's called Hamilton Hall. It's named after our founding father and the first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton. And they draped Hamilton Hall with a Palestinian flag. So shortly after 1 o'clock in the morning this morning, they went in there, they stormed the hall. They used metal barricades, chairs, tables to block people from getting inside. They posted this footage on social media. Of course, there's a woke white woman, a blonde, who you can see in some of this footage is orchestrating all of it. Oh, put a bike lock on this chair to make sure that nobody can get in or out, etc. So Most of these people, I mean, there are a lot of keffiyehs around. There are a lot of surgical masks around. They're not afraid of COVID. They just want to block their faces so they can't be identified. They're smashing windows. Again, all of this on social media and photographs going everywhere. That tells you that they want the signal to go out. They're not trying to hide any of this. They're trying to encourage others across the country to continue down doing what they're doing. And I will say this, looking at a lot of these, and we don't know, there are a lot of outside agitators here too. The funding of this coming from George Soros, as it's been reported, Students for Free Palestine or whatever. I mean, that group has been around for a long time, a couple of decades, being supported by Soros and his organizations. We now know that the Chinese Communist Party via TikTok, etc., financing this, whipping kids up into an anti-Semitic frenzy to act in this way. But you also see a lot of very similar kinds of figures at Columbia that you saw in the Antifa crowds, that you saw in the BLM crowds, and by the way, that you saw at the January 6th riot at the Capitol, sort of all dressed in the same kind of like hoodie with a backpack, mask across their face. So whether you're talking about out and out communist revolts like what you're seeing at Columbia, taking over an entire hall now, after yesterday they were given a deadline, decamp, break down these encampments by 2 p.m. or else what? President Shafiq is going to do what to you exactly? In red states like Georgia and Florida and Texas, you know, they're actually moving in. They're suspending a lot of these kids. Law enforcement is moving in, campus police, but also state troopers, physically lifting these protesters out of there. And while I talk about the kids, yeah, there are a ton of useful idiot kids taking part in this, but you do have professional communist revolutionaries in there as well. As you did on January 6th, as you did Antifa and Black Lives Matter, they don't care what the top line issue is. They care about turning American society upside down, creating the chaos and the mayhem, and destroying our institutions so that they can get power. That is what all of this is about. So it's clearly now ratcheting up. There is violence. There is destruction of property. And we're going to see where this goes, but they're following the playbook, and the playbook says ratchet it up, violence, and then spill over the violence into city streets and then to suburbs, the countryside, the rest of the country. It's a very dangerous moment. When you look in other directions as well, you see the revolution taking on different forms. It's not just the violent revolutionaries at Columbia and elsewhere, but it's also in our government. I want to roll two clips here. Let's start with clip five, Ilhan Omar. She went to Columbia last week, and of course she was there to rile everybody up. Her daughter taking big part in these encampments and protests. She got suspended from Columbia. She whined that she was now homeless and she couldn't live in her dorm or college facility, whatever she was doing. But Ilhan Omar was there in solidarity with her daughter, and she smeared Jewish students at Columbia as being, quote, pro-genocide. Listen.
How do you think this will translate to the Jewish students who are facing anti-Semitism here on campus?
So I actually met a lot of Jewish students that are in the encampment. And I think it is really unfortunate that people don't care about the fact that all Jewish kids should be kept safe and that we should not have to tolerate anti-Semitism or bigotry for all Jewish students, whether they are pro-genocide or anti-genocide.
So you have a member of the Hamas caucus, Ilhan Omar, whipping up the revolution. Because remember, guys, this is, it's not just the communists doing this. You have all of these different forces working together. It's called the Red-Green Alliance. Red for communists, worldwide Marxists, as well as the Chinese Communist Party. All the reds working with the greens, the Islamic supremacists, the pro-Sharia crowd. So it's the Red-Green Alliance working together to destroy the United States and the West. This is why you've got the Marxists working with the Islamic supremacists, etc. This is no coincidence here. This is not, this didn't just happen. So you got a member of Congress who's the part of the Hamas caucus working with the Marxists just out in the open, and you pay for her salary. Here's another Democrat member of Congress, Summer Lee, painting a rosy picture of these anti-Semitic Marxist protests on college campuses, or as she calls them, just kids like engaged in a bit of a good time. Listen.
But this idea that every criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic is dangerous. There is a fair critique that we must make of every government, of every war, of every appropriation. And when we say that students who are engaging in the time-honored tradition of civil disobedience, of campus protests and action are inherently bad or inherently anti-Semitic, particularly as we see Jewish students standing in solidarity with Muslim students or Arab students and Black students, when you're on the ground, you see that all of those students have been working together or have been learning and educating together.
The time-honored tradition of civil disobedience. Well, that has certainly not aged well, because what you're seeing on Columbia is the destruction of property and a ratcheting up of this revolution. You know, they let the peaceful part run for a while, and then they get their tenterhooks into the university. So they set up these encampments, were peaceful protests, protected by the First Amendment, and then they let that go for a while, and then they ratchet it up. It's always testing the university administrators, testing the New York City police, who, by the way, have been fantastic. They can only do so much, you know, et cetera, but they have been excellent. And that Georgia State Trooper put it up on my social media over the weekend, who literally picked up one of these whiny Marxist protesters, literally picked the guy up and threw him off campus. The police have been really good, given their limitations. But you've got members of the Hamas caucus, you've got these Democrats who are actually communists working from the inside. All of this is of a piece. And then you've got the government, you've got the Biden administration paying influencers to continue this going. They're working with the Chinese Communist Party on TikTok and elsewhere to keep this going and rile these people up. Here's OnlyFans personality, Farha Khalidi, who is admitting that she was paid by the Biden administration. Roll it.
So you were getting, the Biden administration was buying ads from you?
Yeah, I was doing full-on political propaganda.
And they would just, really? With like what kind of, like, Biden created 10 million jobs?
Yeah,
this year?
Yeah, honestly. And the funny thing is, they're like, do not disclose this is an ad, because, you know, they're like, technically it's not a product, so you don't have to disclose it's an ad. Because I think they just wanted like some edgy girl of color to just tell people, like, when they nominated like Ketanji Brown Jackson, they're like, can you say, like, as a person of color, you know, that you feel reflected? And it's like a white woman emailing this to me, and she's like giving me this script, and I'm like, no. And she's like, please. And I'm like, no, I'll like talk about the news of it, but I'm not gonna be like, I'm not gonna have a white person tell me to be like, you know, this is how I feel as a person of color. Like,
yeah, exactly. So now they're on OnlyFans as well as TikTok with the Chinese Communist Party, all of a piece. And one final thing on this, how it's all working together. You have these communist judges in Manhattan who are also part of the revolution. You think they're sitting there doing rule of law, enforcing the Constitution? Absolutely not. Engoron, Mershon, all of the Trump judges, and certainly the prosecutors, etc., they're all part of the revolution. So this morning, Judge Mershon slapped Donald Trump with a $9,000 fine for violating his unconstitutional gag order. So he identified nine times that Trump went on True Social or in front of the microphones, violated the gag order. So $1,000 for each violation. And then he said, if you continue, I'm threatening you with jail time. So you know what? Bring it. Bring it. The gag order is unconstitutional. Gagging a former president in the middle of a campaign, the guy who's leading by leaps and bounds now, you've got a gag on him while his political opponent and everybody else can talk trash about him, but he can't push back. Totally unconstitutional. And Trump knows it. The whole thing is a farce. So Trump is not even playing the game. And Mershon is now saying, I'm going to put you in jail if you continue. So you know what? Bring it. We're in the middle of this revolution. Just do it. Do it already. Throw him in jail, and then let's see what happens. You want to go communist? Go full communist. All right, let's hit a quick break here. Speaking of the communist revolution, we're going to deal with the military and how that's been shot through with this woke, very woke, dangerous nonsense and is putting us all at risk. We're going to deal with that coming straight up. Sit tight. You know the saying, if you have your health, you have everything? So true. And if you don't, well, we know how difficult that can be. Thankfully, there are all natural things you can do to improve your health. Have you heard of cancer-fighting foods? The American Cancer Society discovered diets rich in fruits and veggies may actually lower your risk of cancer. Hopefully you hear this and run to the store for 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. But if not, you should consider adding Field of Greens to your daily health regimen. Each fruit and veggie in Field of Greens was doctor selected for studied health benefits. There's a heart health group, lungs, kidneys, and metabolism groups, even a healthy weight group. It's what your body needs in each scoop of delicious Field of Greens. I take Field of Greens. It is delicious. It is phenomenal. I feel so much better, actually more alive when I'm taking Field of Greens. Will Field of Greens prevent, treat, or cure cancer? No. But it's so powerful that it promises that at your next checkup, your doctor will notice your improved health or your money back. Can't beat that, right? Here's even more good news. I got you 15% off and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code Monica for your discount. That's promo code Monica at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com, promo code Monica. Get started. Improve your health today. Well, joining us now for a very important and actually very kind of dark conversation, but we are going to end on notes of hope here, is Amber Smith. Amber is a former deputy assistant to the Secretary of Defense. She is also a former U.S. Army OH-58D Kiowa Warrior helicopter pilot. How's that for a mouthful? An air mission commander in the 101st Airborne Division, which if anybody knows any kind of military history going way back, certainly World War II and beyond, the 101st Airborne is a legendary unit, and Amber was part of it. She's all over Fox News, Newsmax. You see her all the time. Her official website is officialambersmith.com. On Instagram and Twitter, you can find her at AmberSmithUSA. And she is also the author of a very important new book called Unfit to Fight, How Woke Policies Are Destroying Our Military. It's available now wherever you get your books, so go get it. And Amber joins us now. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Monica. It's great to be on with you.
Well, it is so good to have you here. And as soon as I saw your book, I said, I've got to have Amber on. We both served in the Trump administration. You were at DOD and I was at the Treasury Department. And so we've seen government from the inside out. We see how the sausage is made. A lot of times, not very pretty. And of course, yeah. You have dedicated your life to the armed forces, serving the United States of America, putting yourself on the line, your very life on the line. You flew combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so you know what you're talking about here. There's a lot to unpack in this book. So I want to start with the overall premise of your book, Amber, because you write about, you really expose the woke policies that those of us who have never served in the military but are paying attention to the news, we hear about this all the time, that these woke policies are infecting our military and putting our brave men and women who volunteer to serve, putting their lives in danger, not to mention the rest of us and the future of the country. So when you talk about woke policies, can you walk us through exactly what you mean?
Yeah, so woke policies is... So when I first got interested in writing this book, it was... I sort of had a unique perspective of the contrast of me serving in the military at a very operational level and then being more at the senior level in the E-ring of the Pentagon. And like you said, seeing the policy decisions that are made like up at the top, and the disconnect between the people who have to fight the wars, do the missions, and the people in Washington, D.C. sort of up at the top making some of the decisions. And so... and the senior leaders in the military. And so I got to sort of see an inside view of how the culture inside the military had changed very rapidly since I had served, and really taking a drastic shift from focusing on the mission, being successful in being the most lethal, effective fighting force in the world that had the best training and readiness in order to be able to destroy and defeat our enemies, to focusing on a diversity, equity, and inclusion culture, one that was trying to be inclusive and pointing out uniqueness and individuality of a soldier in an institution that has historically been successful because it actually focuses on cohesion and trust and teamwork. And so you saw sort of a 180 in this cultural push from the Department of Defense. And you see critical race theory being taught at the academies to these who will soon be young lieutenants and our future military leaders and will be leading soldiers on the battlefield. And you want them, you know, learning about battlefield strategy and leadership techniques and history. And instead they're being taught about white rage, classes on whiteness, and everything that comes with CRT. So this push to stop focusing on the mission and push DEI has had disastrous effects for the military as a whole.
You know, Amber, as I was going through your book and you know, reading it and thinking about these issues, it occurred to me that for decades, you know, certainly after the draft was ended by President Nixon in the early 1970s and we became an all-volunteer force, that the U.S. military, along with professional sports leagues like the NFL, that those organizations had the least amount of racism in it because it was all merit-based and everybody was treated exactly the same. And in the military, you had to perform or you were out. You voluntarily stepped up to join the organization. You were integrated into the organization, and it didn't matter what race you were or what background you were, whether you were wealthy, whether you were poor, it didn't matter. It was the most integrated, probably representative organization in the country, and worked its mission, which is to fight and kill the enemy if necessary, right? And then as you're saying, when did this really all start? Did it start in the 90s? Did it start later?
So, I mean, the drastic shift really started under the Obama administration, and we saw the transgender policy change. We saw the women serving in special operations and ground combat units, that ban be lifted, and the beginning of DEI under the Obama administration. And you're absolutely right. It pushed the military from a very successful institution that thrived being a meritocracy, and pushed it on one that was full of double standards and a two-tier justice system, and, you know, pushed leaders to not speak out against some of these things and instead promoted them. You even had who is now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff pushing out a memo in the Air Force saying that he thinks that the pilot corps in the Air Force is too white and they need to make it more diverse. And you've heard it from Secretary Austin and President Biden that, you know, they want a military that looks like America. And the problem there is that the military has a very specific mission. And like I said, when I served, that's why everybody goes to basic training or the officer equivalent of it, is they break you down and they build everybody back up together. where it doesn't matter your background, your wealth, you know, if you didn't have a mom or a dad or whatever, it doesn't matter. You all get built back up together. You all have the same opportunity. And then you get to pursue what you want to pursue. If you're the best person for the job and you excel, then that's the path that you take. But that's not what it is anymore. Instead, you see the military and leaders focusing on individuality of characteristics that people cannot control, like what they're born with, like the color of their skin or their gender. We see military officers using their OERs, their officer evaluation report, to list some of these accomplishments of people that have been promoted. And what's very interesting is that in the Obama years, you know, people were trying to do this sort of cultural shift behind the scenes. In Biden's military, what we are seeing is an overt acceptance and push of the agenda. You had a general speaking publicly at an event talking about how she would place a transgender or, you know, someone of the LGBTQ community in a command position over someone more qualified if she had to. And so that is just showing that they're not trying to hide it anymore. They have this agenda and they are moving full speed ahead with it.
And we've also seen these trans members of the military pushed out front and center. So Admiral Rachel Levine is clearly a man, presents as a woman. They have made him, as a primary spokesperson for the military under President Obama. You're exactly right. I mean, and this is happening at all levels. You know, when they talk about how the military, and they talk about this about most of our institutions, that they should reflect American society. So the military should look like America looks. Well, you know what? When we had all volunteer force before all of this DEI, Amber, we actually did have a military that reflected the broad range of American society. But now that they've actively gone down this road, right? It is less a group of lethal professionals to protect and defend the homeland and our interests abroad. And now it's like a social justice experiment. Right.
And what you're seeing as a result of that is people not wanting to join the military.
Right.
In 2022, the Army missed its recruitment numbers by 25% and have missed them every year since. And so what is at risk here is the all-volunteer force. American society has, you know, got to have like reap the benefits of an all-volunteer force since the end of Vietnam. We were able to build up our military and had enough patriotic Americans that love their country that they were willing to serve in whatever capacity that was right for them. Because of the debacle in Afghanistan, because of the withdrawal and evacuation that followed it, because of the COVID mandates, where you saw this like tyranny inside the military of leadership who were acting outside the law and forced out over 8,000 able-bodied, you know, service members who had significant experience and were actually the type of leader that the military needs today, kicked them out, and then mix in all of this woke policies, the DEI, the CRT, the transgender and pride things, where it's really been such a major distraction to the military and those who served, that has forced it to lose focus on the military. You have senior leaders saying that there needs to be an extremism stand down day because white supremacy is the biggest internal threat to the military, which in an individual investigation found that there was only 100 instances of any sort of issues with extremism, which compare that to society is extremely low. Mm-hmm. But what did Austin do? He spent, you know, millions of dollars on a stand down day, lost, you know, valuable and precious training time that a lot of service members aren't getting today. And that's just an example of the priorities of losing focus on the mission. Like it's pretty simple. does this make the military a more lethal fighting force to destroy our enemy? If the answer to that question is no, in almost any instance, then the military should not be wasting their time on it. And sadly, that is all they're wasting their time on these days. And therefore, weakening our military, our adversaries see it, and it's really putting our future at risk, our all-volunteer force at risk. And, you know, I talk about this extensively in my book about the all-volunteer force and what happens when there's no one left.
It is so dangerous to contemplate and so dark to contemplate as well, because I think most of the American people grew up under this idea of American superpower, because it actually was a reality. And the backbone of American superpower, you know, two backbones, economic and military, including nuclear weapons and a fighting force that can go off and do the kind of work that needs to be done around the world to protect us and our interests. And now we've got a weakened economy and we've got a military force. I mean, God love anybody who will stand up and volunteer for America's armed forces like you did, Amber. Huge, huge respect. There's no way that we can offer enough gratitude to you and your colleagues. But the leadership at the top, where all of this DEI nonsense, this wet blanket of social justice that has infected these institutions, is putting America in a very dangerous moment and a very dangerous situation. You talk about recruiting levels getting very dangerously low. I think about the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, who we now know was totally political, anti-Trump. There's stuff coming out now that he refused to take on Trump's orders as commander-in-chief, disavowed them, whether it's January 6th or whatever it might be. He was a nightmare. And I remember when he was called to testify and he was asked about this, he said, well, yes, we do teach white rage. I want to know about white rage. And I'm white. I mean, if you're a kid in the Midwest and you're thinking about joining the military, Amber, and you see that clown at the head of the military, and then you see Rachel Levine, who wants to join and serve under that kind of command?
Exactly. General Milley absolutely destroyed the reputation and the legacy of the military. The Department of Defense used to pride itself on being apolitical, and sort of back to what I was talking about, how they're overt about it now, they are not even trying to hide how political they have become. And when you get above 06 level, full brig colonel, you become a politician. You become a yes man. That is what we're seeing in the office corps today, above that rank, where their leaders are failing up. They fall in line, and they keep their mouths shut, and they nod their head yes, and they know they will move up in the ranks. And this is a disaster for some leaders who are in charge of a military force that is tasked with making decisions that are responsible for people's lives. And so to have that sort of weak leadership is a disaster. I'll give you another example. As the Secretary of the Army, when we talk about readiness, you hear the military leaders spout off the talking points about readiness. They use readiness as an excuse for everything, to push their agenda or to, you know, get more funding, whatever. But it's not true. We saw it with the COVID vaccine, and then we've seen it with the transgender push. They talk about how, well, readiness, we need, you know, to ensure that everyone who's capable could serve in the military. Serving in the military is not a right. It's not a guarantee. You have to meet qualifications and standards. Well, the Army physical fitness test was gender and age neutral. The Secretary of the Army said she was fearful that it was going to significantly damage female recruitment and retention because the physical standard was much higher. So what did she do? She then lowered the standard, even lower than it was prior to the gender and age neutral standard, and lowered the standard to keep more women in. Now, the contrast is pushing this transgender policy that allows men who decide they want to be women, if they change their gender on the military ID card, that gives them full and unrestricted access to female sleeping quarters to showers, locker rooms, bathrooms, you name it. What do you think is going to hurt readiness and recruitment? Do you think an 18-year-old female is going to say, oh, I'm going to go sign up for a military where I will be forced to shower with a man? Mm. And then if I speak out against it, I'm going to get in trouble? No, it is a huge deterrent to recruitment. So I'm just showing the contrast and the double standards and hypocrisy of leaders at the top, like trying to just push their woke agenda over reality of what's going to work to fix this recruitment crisis.
You know, you just used a phrase, and I want to follow up on this. You said leaders at the top. You know, Amber, we often hear with regard to our other corrupted institutions, like the FBI and the Department of Justice and others, that it's just a couple of bad woke apples at the top, but the rank and file are dedicated patriots. Now, okay, that may apply in some of these organizations to some people, okay? And, you know, I don't discount that. But when I, for example, when I take a look at the FBI raiding Mar-a-Lago or the FBI going after some of these nonviolent January 6th defendants, raiding them at 4 o'clock in the morning, the abject glee with which these rank and file folks are carrying out these corrupt agendas tells me that it's not just the people at the very top executing an agenda. It's a lot of people all the way throughout these organizations, and that this is a lot more pervasive all the way through. What's your view with regard to the military?
Yes, so I agree. It is not just surface level. It runs very, very deep. And it's an agenda. It's a culture. And in the military, you have, like you said, the sort of the operator level, the people who come in just to serve their country and they want to participate and be a part of, you know, preserving our future for future generations. You have those people that are like, I just want to do this, right? Can I come in and I serve my country? But you do, as you do get into like the mid-level and up, where things become a little bit more political, and you have to worry about your future and getting promoted. And you realize that if you are someone who asks questions or brings up the hypocrisy or says, hey, this doesn't actually make sense for my troops, for my service members that I am leading, you know, those are the people that get put in a closet and get passed up for promotion. You saw it with the COVID vaccine mandates when you had leaders actually read Secretary Austin's COVID vaccine order and then apply it to what the officer above him was ordering them to do, which was to take a vaccine that Secretary Austin had not ordered, which was not approved, and they stood up for their troops. You know, they were forced out of the military. The military no longer wants people who are going to stand up for what's right, unless, like, if you're standing up for some of these woke policies, then of course they're exactly who they want to stick around. So it runs deep, and that's why correcting the problem, like getting it back on track, is going to be generational. It's not something that's going to be able to fix, you know, with a single administration. They'll be able to do a few things, executive orders here and there, and rip up some of the Biden administration policies. But because of what I said earlier about how the military academies have been infiltrated with these woke policies and CRT, and then taking that education and then joining the military and leading troops, it is cultural now. And as with anything, even outside the military, cultural issues take a very, very long time to change.
Yeah. You know, it takes very little, a very short amount of time for Marxists like this to get into any institution and destroy it. Very little amount of time, but it takes a long time to turn it around. You know, I think about New York City, which was just at the bottom of the barrel when Rudy Giuliani came in. It took him a long time to turn around that city, and then Michael Bloomberg trying to keep it on an even keel. And then Bill de Blasio comes in, and within like a month, 2 months, destroys all of it. So they're very good at destroying institutions, but not very good at rebuilding, even if they want to rebuild it as sort of some sort of communist instrument, which is what I think they're doing with the military, like all of our institutions. Can you drill down for a minute, Amber? You can address that, but I also want you to address, you know, you talked about combat readiness. You talk about the recruiting levels being dangerously low. You talk about how failure leads to promotion because nobody wants to stick their head up too much because they're going to get penalized for doing that. But drill down even further to unit cohesion, which is so important in a combat situation. You need to be able to rely on the person next to you in the foxhole or in the helicopter or on the plane. And now, if you have all of this DEI advancement, are the people who are actually playing by the rules, do they look at the person next to them askance? Like, hey, man, does this person next to me really belong next to me? Have they been trained? Do they know what they're doing? Am I okay to put my life in their hands?
You just hit the nail on the head about something that is so important in the military, and it's trust. It's cohesion, it's teamwork, and that is everything in the military, working as a team to be able to accomplish the mission. And the trust that comes along with it isn't just given out. You don't just walk into a unit and, you know, join the unit is a team, and suddenly everyone accepts you and, you know, you just like move forward together. That trust is something that is absolutely earned. And so, sadly, what we have seen under some of these policies is this severe breakdown of the trust that comes with teamwork, and also that leader-subordinate relationship. So when you have, you know, when you're in combat and a leader tells his troop to go charge that hill while the bullets are flying, it is that trust in their commander that a soldier agrees to go do that for, because they trust their judgments, they trust their decision, that decision is what is absolutely best to accomplish what the team, the unit, has to do. And so that's been severely severed because they're seeing these standards be lowered for to allow other people into some of these positions. And so, yeah, now that they're in, you look to your left and you look to your right and you're like, wait, so are you on the side that is here because you absolutely deserve it, you can pass every standard and you're the best person for this job? Or do I look to my left and are you the person that's here because they needed to meet a quota? That destroys trust, and that someone will always have to carry the extra weight of people who are there that can't meet that standard. And so, you know, what does that do? That creates weak links in the chain. Sooner or later, it's going to break. And it's not like every single person on a team serves a purpose. And when you have people there where other people are having to pick up their weight, it is just a recipe for disaster. Not only does it, like I said, break down that trust of the team, but it also means that they are a weaker unit as a whole and may not be able to accomplish that mission.
Yeah, you know, it's bad enough when you have that lack of trust if you're working at the local dry cleaner, right? And you look at somebody who's been hired and you're like, oh man, they don't deserve to be here. But when you're talking about the military, it's a question of literal life and death for the individuals involved, as well as the life and death of the mission and the life and death of the country. This is the magnitude of what we're talking about here. Amber, if you are a Chinese leader, if you're Xi Jinping, or you're head of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army in Beijing, if you're the Iranian mullahs, the Iranian Revolutionary National Guard, if you are Vladimir Putin and you're sitting in the Kremlin, if you are a terrorist leader of ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah, Hamas, and you take a look at what is going on in the U.S. military, what do you think?
Weakness. I see them, especially under Biden, seeing a door that has been opened, and them looking to take advantage of the weakness. And you have, I mean, they see sort of the infighting of someone like General Milley, who called up his Chinese counterpart and said that he would notify him of a military strike prior to it happening. you see that come out, and then you see the double standard of Space Force commanders getting fired because they do a podcast that talks about how Marxism has infiltrated the military, and that, you know, the two-tier justice system, one gets fired for speaking the truth, and the other one is giving advance notice of a possible military strike to our number one adversary in the world, and nobody bats an eye. Nobody thinks anything of it whatsoever. They see that. They see weakness. They see a divisiveness where there's no unity, and they know that that means that when you're divided, when you have all these problems, it means you are not as strong. And so I really think they're questioning about, you said, that U.S. military superiority that we've had for so long. I think a lot of our adversaries are saying, like, should we call their bluff? Is it still true? And that's a sad place to be.
Well, you mentioned how our adversaries see weakness. They also see opportunity, as you just mentioned, both to take advantage of the discord in our military, but also to advance their own interests around the world, which is why you've got Hamas attacking Israel, which is why you had Russia going into Ukraine, and perhaps even the Chinese Communist Party going into Taiwan. They see weakness plus opportunity with a weak commander-in-chief and a weakened United States military. Two final questions for you. The first one, Amber, is How much are our adversaries involved in this? So we do know that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, is involved in helping to instigate and spread these pro-Hamas terrorist-sympathizing protests in the streets. They want American society destabilized. So if you look at it that way, how much of our adversaries are either directly or indirectly involved in undermining our military?
I think socially, significantly, we've been hearing things about TikTok and how the CCP has been purposely pushing agendas through social media. I think that's very real and happening. Also, I think they are 100% using it to their advantage. You have American service members who are, you know, going on social media and airing their grievances about the military. And on one edge of it, it is exposing some of the problems that exist in the military today and the leadership problems that come out of it. But it's also our adversaries are there to take full advantage of, you know, what the result of that is. And so I think you're going to continue to see our adversaries, you know, pushing their agenda through some of these different sites and, you know, doing whatever methods that they can to further weaken us. You don't see China or Iran or Russia or North Korea, you know, advertising their, like, you know, transgender circle of every single service member or service branch. You don't see them saying that service members are going to get punished if they aren't using their pronouns in their bios or doing gender, taking away tradition and making everything gender neutral when it comes to creeds and songs and all of the above, and focusing on what type of artwork is in the hallways and if it's diverse enough. You see our adversaries doing one thing, and it's training to destroy their enemy and ensuring they're ready to do so. That is their mission. That's what the United States military used to be about. Mm-hmm. They used to be focused. They used to be ensure that, like, that litmus test question that I asked earlier about, does this make the military a more lethal fighting force? That used to be the focus. That is what our adversary's focus is. And with all of the distractions that we've seen today, in this military and under this leadership, it has caused weakness around the world. We didn't see World War III risks or threats happening every other week under the Trump administration. But yet under the Obama administration and this push with weakening our military, that's what we're seeing around the globe today.
Well, that's right, because American weakness is provocative, and it offers temptations that, frankly, if you are Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin, you would be remiss if you did not take advantage of them. because, you know, if they see a window of opportunity to advance their own interests, they're going to take it, or they have a dereliction of their own duty. Okay, final question for you, Amber. How do we fix this? I mean, how does the average person listening to us today, who may have served back, you know, Vietnam era, Korea, World War on Terror era, or maybe hasn't served at all, how do we as average Americans turn this around? How do we lean on our elected officials and military officials to change the entire approach here?
Well, there's a couple things that do have to happen internally to the military. One of them is accountability, because this culture of no accountability is running rampant through the military right now, especially at the top. Like you saw in World War II, a general would be given a couple months to be effective on the battlefield. If they could not, they were fired and replaced by someone who could. Fast forward Vietnam, you saw this shift in the military at the Department of Defense, where leaders did not want to hold generals and flag officers accountable for performance. They saw a firing of a general as this sort of black eye on the institution as a whole, that it was this negative PR that they didn't want. So they circled the wagons, and instead of firing people, they just, you know, continued to kick the can down the road or moved them into a different job. A few decades later, where we are now, it is extremely rare for a general to be fired for performance. You may see someone get fired for conduct, personal conduct, but it is not for performance. So we have got to bring that accountability culture back, where if you cannot perform to the level that you need to be successful, for your unit to be successful, then it's time for somebody else to do the job. Also, the general officer corps is extremely bloated across the Department of Defense. It could be slashed in half. Like, that is obviously not what's going to happen day one, but eventually they need to slim down those numbers. So that's the accountability piece. The other piece that has to happen is bringing the military back to a meritocracy. The military cannot function as it is today successfully and want the same outcomes that we have enjoyed in previous decades. So that means a new presidential administration coming in, ripping up the executive orders from the Biden administration, working jointly with the Secretary of Defense, the service secretaries, the COCOM commanders, Congress as well. Congress carries a heavy piece of the accountability piece here, and saying we're gonna get back to an institution that cares about the best people being placed in the jobs because they're the right person for the job, not because of their gender, not because of their skin color, not because we need to meet some, you know, social quota by chasing these social agendas. And that both of those things that I just mentioned are going to be an extremely hard task to accomplish because the culture runs deep. But those are two good steps to start with that have to happen in order to turn the ship.
Absolutely. You know, you did describe a very heavy lift here, but it's absolutely necessary because the threat is existential. If you do not have a powerful military that is able to be operational in the most effective kind of way, then you cannot defend your homeland. You cannot defend your interests. You cannot defend the American people. And we're quickly getting to that point. So as difficult an enterprise as this is to turn this around, you need leadership at the top willing to do it. And, you know, the Pentagon, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Amber, but I think the Pentagon is the biggest employer in the country. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes, it's the biggest government agency, yeah.
Right. So, it's going to require leadership at the top from the Commander-in-Chief and the new Secretary of Defense to turn this thing around. And things are going to have to be ripped out root and branch which is very painful for any institution once these things get deeply entrenched, as all of this nonsense is now in the military. But we really have no choice if we want to continue to have a country that exists and is not, we're not all going to be speaking Chinese here within 5 or 10 years. So, Amber, I want to thank you so much for writing this book and raising the alarm. Any other final words?
Sure. I would just say that it is so important for the American public to be paying attention to this issue right now. A lot of people didn't consider, you know, wokeism infiltrating the military, because a big chunk of recruitment comes from red states. But sadly, it has happened, and people have got to see what's going on at the Department of Defense so you can, so we can try to fix it.
Well, I really give you a lot of credit for writing this book and raising the alarm. I know it's not easy to speak out against the prevailing trends, but you've done this in this book because you've seen it up close and personal in our military. You've devoted your life to the U.S. military and to protecting the rest of us. So I so appreciate you, Amber. The book is called Unfit to Fight: How Woke Policies Are Destroying Our Military. The author is Amber Smith. It is available wherever you get your books, so please go get it. Check her out on her website, officialambersmith.com, and on Instagram and Twitter at AmberSmithUSA. Thanks so much, Amber.
Thanks, Monica.
All right, guys, this was a very, very important show, so thank you so much for joining me. As always, please tell everybody you know about this show. We need to educate every single person, both here and across the West, as to the reality of what is going on. So please tell everybody you know. Appreciate you guys so much. Have a good, safe start to your week. We will be right back here on Thursday. I'll see you then. This episode of the Monica Crowley Podcast was produced by Behakel Entertainment, LLC.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.